Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the birth of what we know as big science, the big money supported cross-institution collaborations that have supported both medicine and weaponry. And first, beyond ending war. What does it take to make a lasting quality peace? With us is Professor Peter Wallenstein. He's a professor of peace and conflict research at Uppsala University, Sweden, and a research professor of peace studies in the Joan B. Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He's the author of Quality Peace, Peacebuilding, Victory, and World Order, Understanding Conflict Resolution, Peace, War, and the Global System, and the editor of the volume International Sanctions, Between Wars and Words. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Peter Wallenstein. It's great to have you here with us.
It is my pleasure to talk to you.
Let's start with the very premise of your new book, Quality Peace. How do you distinguish what it means to have quality peace as opposed to peace that doesn't have quality?
This comes from a lot of discussions about peace building and what happens after a war and whether it is satisfactory only that the war ends and we should then call that peace. So we talk about the end of the Second World War as peace coming to Europe or Asia. But of course, that is pretty unsatisfactory. It's fine that the war is over, but there needs to be more, because what we are really concerned about is the recurrence of war, that it will come back. So trying to think about that and trying to see what other scholars have done, I came to the conclusion that we should call this quality peace. The kind of peace we want is not just the absence of war, it's also something that has the conditions that will prevent the recurrence of war.
So that was
the background. Yeah.
So it is actually a lasting peace.
It is a lasting peace, but not one which is achieved through repression or deterrence or negative matters like that. It's not a negative lasting peace. It's one that has more of a quality to it.
So maybe we can start to articulate what that quality is as we go on. Maybe we should also talk a bit about what the literature had found before that you've actually been contributing to. And there seems to have been like three primary paradigms. I wonder if you could just outline these first around security, economy, institutions.
Yes, there's been a lot of a discussion, for instance, by a researcher named Roland Paris, which did a very important book more than 10 years ago, where he emphasized the role of institutions, and he was more negative, so to say, or felt that it was more important to develop institutions and then after that go to issues of democracy, elections, etc. There is also other researchers that emphasize more the role of the local society, local capacity. And then you have the researchers that emphasize the role of economics in order to prevent the recurrence of war. So what I try to do is to integrate all these ideas as basically hypotheses about what would be a good quality. And then I want to apply that to concrete situations around the world.
So now if we were going to take the, you know, sort of big picture contextual things that you also noted in your book, for example, peace agreements seem to have been on the rise. Is that right?
Yes, they definitely have. And it is a big contrast to the situation during the Cold War, when there was very little of peace agreements, very few, and where the kind of peace we had in those years was a highly negative peace. It was built on deterrence. And then when the Cold War ends, lots of conflicts which don't end automatically. And here you get a lot of negotiations, incredible efforts at mediation, and so you get this rise of peace agreements that have been more than 200 by now since the end of the Cold War. And that's quite unique compared to other historical periods, not the least as many of these are peace agreements on internal conflicts.
There's been a bit of a debate also, it seems, about whether conflict itself is diminishing. When we look at what's in our news, it looks like conflict is getting worse. But there are people such as Steven Pinker, for example, who argue, no, we've got fewer deaths, this sort of a thing, if you look at it from a big picture. What do you say to all this? Who's telling the truth here?
Yeah, both can be right, actually. So what Pinker shows is a long-term trend, which I think is correct since the end of the Second World War, that the conflicts today are not, let's say at least not yet, as bad as those we saw during the Cold War. If you think about the Korean War, Vietnam War, Afghanistan War, Iran-Iraq War, these were really tremendously destructive conflicts. And many of those that we have seen since the end of the Cold War are problematic, but not necessarily as bad as those. But what the Uppsala Conflict Data Program records is an increase in the last few years. And in 2014, which is the latest they have reported on, it's quite clear a strong increase both in number of people killed and the number of conflicts. So we might right now be at a sort of a transition here where it's very crucial how conflicts are dealt with, whether it will be a rise or whether it will go back to the gradual decline that we saw before.
So if we looked at, say, for example, how peace agreements have been on the rise, if we understand what accounts for that, does it help us to facilitate them in the coming years?
I think so, because the results from the past 25 years show clearly that negotiated endings to wars have a greater chance of providing conditions where there will not be a return to conflict. Victory, which is often what the parties strive for, in fact can result in more recurrence of conflict and they result in a peace situation that have less of qualities than you would want, so to say. So victories are not necessarily the best solution to a conflict if you think in the long term. The agreements, peace agreements, may many times be the preferable ones.
I want to go back to that in just a bit. One other thing I was wondering is, do you have a sense of why we did have increasing peace agreements? I think your book said something like 178 in the last 20 years versus something like 28 in the previous.
There was more of an agreement among the major powers that we should deal with conflict in a different way than we have before. During the Cold War, the idea was constantly to exploit conflicts for the particular side's own purposes. One was supporting particular actors and wanted them to win. Whereas after the Cold War, the approach became more one of humanitarian concern. These are bad situations. People are suffering. So let us now, also on the big power level, solve them through negotiations. So there is a connection, so to say, between what happens on the big power level all the way down to the local negotiations. And what has been my and many's worry in the last 2 years is that this tension that we see between Western powers and Russia, in particular on the other side, actually has a negative effect in the way conflicts are dealt with in some crucial parts of the world.
How so?
It means that we are all suffering from the ability or the inability of the leaders of the major powers in the world to cooperate or not. And it is normally good that there is some degree of tension, but when it, because otherwise they become overpowering, so to say. But it has to be possible still to work out constructive arrangements. But what we have seen in the last 2 years has been the conflicts over Georgia, the conflict over Ukraine, and the conflict over Syria, and that has prevented reasonable negotiations and peace agreements in these conflicts.
I think you also note is that there are these different kinds of conflicts. And in fact, what we see today is quite a different kind of war than what we've seen in the past. How would you help us to understand these different kinds of wars and conflicts and the impact that that makes on how to bring peace?
Yes, I think this is an important additional point in this book. That is to separate between conflicts which are civil wars, where the battle is about who shall rule in a particular country. And there is a lot of agreements, peace agreements on this, and many of them fail, but they continue again and again. And then you have those wars where the idea is to separate parts of the country by joining a neighboring country or becoming an independent actor. There are fewer agreements, more difficult to reach, and require more negotiations. But once they have been settled, they are often settled for the long term. So I separate between civil wars and these kind of conflicts, which I call the state formation conflicts. They are about how the state should be like. So if you take examples, you can say Ukraine and Georgia both have very strong elements of this with the state formation. The conflict in Syria, on the other hand, is largely focused on the Assad regime and basically who shall rule in the whole country. And that creates very different dynamics for the settlement of the conflict and how you arrange the situation after the war.
So how would you approach each of these, given what you know about what it takes to make a quality peace?
Yes, I single out three factors which I think are important for quality peace. And one I call the respect for human dignity. The other one I call providing safety and security. And the third one, to provide the predictability that the present conditions are likely to remain. So if I explain that a little more, human dignity matters. It would be to see that if there are ethnic groups, regional concerns, religious concerns involved in the conflict, the solution will have to include something which respects. And in a peace agreement, you can build that in. You can have minority protection, you can make constitutional arrangements, etc. In a victory, it's often one group that rules over the other group, and that, so to say, cements the differences. The second aspect about the security, well, that's more traditional. It has to do with providing for disarmament, demobilization, bringing people from military into civil concerns and so on and so forth. And I think there's a lot of writing on that already. And the third one I think is particularly intriguing to me, and that is if there has been peace for a while, it appears that people are then expecting peace to prevail, and by expecting peace to prevail, it will prevail, so to say. So there is a peace begets peace kind of dynamics. And unfortunately, then the opposite as well. If there has been a lot of conflict in recent history, it is more likely that there will be conflict again. So here we have two very different cycles of expectations, and they have real strong impacts on the way society is functioning.
So that's really about the idea of the self-fulfilling prophecy.
It is, yes. So self-fulfilling and self-destructing in a way as well.
And there are some examples historically that you opened the book with in which there were some pretty bad conflicts, for example, in Europe. But once they came to a quality peace, it's just a new normal that there's peace there. Can you talk about those?
I find that quite interesting. And what I really want with this book is really to point people in the direction. We need to look more at this. I'm, for instance, interested in interstate relationships and how do things change between countries that have been at war. You take the prime example in European history, that's Germany and France, where we today expect them to cooperate. And indeed, one of the terrorist groups in Paris wanted to blow up the stadium where there was a friendship soccer game between, or football as we would say, between Germany and France, which is a symbol, so to say, of a peace that has been created between countries that have been at war before. And I'm asking myself, what was central in changing this? And one key factor I think we can learn from is that they managed to settle all territorial disputes between themselves. And after that, it was possible to develop the kind of close cooperation that we now see taking place. So I think there is an interesting lesson there for other parts of the world. Do not let territorial disputes linger, but instead try to solve them as quickly as possible.
There's some other things that you talked about in this book, and I just wanted to clarify what exactly you mean. One example was you talked about world order and how much that matters. What do you mean by that?
World order has often been a fairly conservative notion, and it's seen as a degree of sort of stability, a status quo orientation. But I'm arguing that there could be different qualities to it as well. So in one sense, the Cold War was a world order, but it was one building on the principles of rivalry, continuous contestation. Everybody is very concerned about his or her own interest, but not really taking care of what the other one is thinking. So you get this constant rivalry. I call it a particularistic relationship. Whereas with the ending of the Cold War, you get a new kind of relationship, which is more universalistic. It's more, okay, I understand what your concerns are. Let me see if I can meet my concerns, but without necessarily hurting yours or making situation worse for you. And that's a more cooperative attitude. And so that becomes a different world order. It's still big powers, but they relate to each other in a different way. And that is what I mean that the world order can be. It can have a quality other than just being a stability and maintaining big powers' rule over others. No, it can have a different quality. And I thought it was interesting to take this concept a world order and give it a little different meaning in this way.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we've been talking about strategies for building lasting quality peace with Peter Wallenstein. There were some other aspects, too, that you talked about. One was strategic peace building. What do you mean by strategic peace building?
This is a concept that has been used very much at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies, where I'm located right now. The idea with this is, again, similar. It is to broaden the perspective here on what peace building is, away a little from the traditional focus just on the absence of war conditions, but try to think of it in a much larger context. My objection is a little that it can become too wide, that it includes too much. It becomes a little too much also of development issues. But if we are talking about peace, we have to bring out factors that really are important exactly for the onset of war or the recurrence of war and keeping actors in war rather than the entire development problematic. So I wanted to narrow it a little, and that's why I preferred to talk about it as peace building, where you build this quality peace that I outlined.
You also noted that there are sometimes unintentional peacemaking that goes on. Perhaps the best example was what was going on up until the Berlin Wall fell.
Yes, it's interesting to try to understand what happened there and during the Cold War and the way relationships were changed, for example, in Western Europe, compared to how they changed or did not change in Eastern Europe. And it becomes almost a contrast of two victorious powers, but the kind of order, to use that term again, they create on each side becomes very different. And the Western one is a victory, of course, over Germany. But the way Germany is integrated is much more respectful and much more concerned about building democracy, accountability, etc. in Germany and Western Germany in those days. Whereas in the Eastern side, it's much more an exploitative relationship, getting the resources, pushing down the East Germans, making them into loyal allies, but not really developing something that would last beyond the use of power to keep them in place. And you could also see that this is the way the Cold War ends. The Western societies survive and continue. The Eastern ones succumb and, in effect, join the European Union, the sort of former enemy.
If we were going to then stop and take a look at these, really looks like there's no end to the conflict, like what's going on in the Middle East with ISIS and the animosities between, say, Iran and Saudi Arabia, and then there's the animosity between Turkey and its own Kurds, and everybody having their own interest in this area. How would you apply your findings about how to create a lasting quality peace in a region like this where you've got so many fragmented interests and so much animosity between groups?
Yes, that's a real challenge and not so easy to respond to. In some way, it confirms some of the results that I present. I mean, when you have conflict and you repeat conflict, it becomes an expectation of conflicts, and it's like many of the actors in the Middle East are now just expecting conflicts and nothing else. And sure enough, it means they are willing to ally with the enemy, the friends of my enemy's enemies, and so on and so forth. You get the very traditional dynamics here going, which are really hard to break, and that's what I think we can see here. Of course, the way out, I think, for the Syrian question is the central issue, and that is the Assad regime. That's how the whole thing started, and that is the key thing. And if one can find a reasonable way in which Mr. Assad can leave, and you can get a new regime with more legitimacy to a larger group of people in Syria, and that would improve the chances. But of course, we can see Mr. Assad himself have little incentive of leaving, and he, sure enough, tries to make the allies that he can, and we could see him in a picture with the Russian leader, Mr. Putin, not long ago. So he has important backers here, and that is part of the reason why it becomes so stalemated. I've been thinking what one can do, because ISIS appears as a new actor and has been able to antagonize almost all the neighbors and many other actors. So in that sense, it becomes maybe a actor that creates cooperation among all the others in order to defeat this particular actor. And that may, in the long run, perhaps help a peaceful approach.
I wonder, too, though, that becomes a victory in your for those people who ally against.
Could very well be.
Would then be counter to other lasting peace agreements.
Yes, and I think the underlying important issue there is that ISIS draws its support from the Sunni population, and that's the majority population in Syria. It's a minority population in Iraq. And so it needs to, in some way, find assurances to the Sunni population that they also have a future. I think that's the real challenge, how to reach to them, and because the Assad regime, of course, is based on a minority, not on the Sunnis, and that's part of the rebellion. And that makes things really hard. You need to find a way in which you can reach out to the Sunni majority in Syria and find representatives there, which right now, of course, will not stand up against ISIS. But if things change, they might feel more safe to actually do it. But for the time being, they don't. As you can hear, I don't have this perfect 5-point plan for how to deal with it. It is a real difficult challenge.
I can see how this one would be vexing for all peace scholars combined. What about the case of Israel and Palestine? What would you say in that case?
I've been part of a book project where we tried to think about a two-state solution, but in a different way. It would be a two-state solution, but it would cover the entire territory. So you would be citizens of two different states, but they would all be within the entire Palestinian territory, so to say. Because what has happened in the past few years with the Israeli settlements, the building of the wall, etc., it really makes it more and more difficult to have a viable Palestinian state on the small territories that remain in the West Bank and in the Gaza. So we need to think about something broader and more difficult. So we suggested this idea of two states but one land. And it's a little daring idea, but it is to try to think a little outside the box and try to get a new thinking into also this particular conflict.
Let's turn to Africa and some of the internal conflicts there. For example, in the Horn of Africa, what can you see as a possibility?
I think the central question here is the border conflict that remains between Ethiopia and Eritrea, and which generates a lot of fear between these two governments. We had a very, very vicious war there in the end of the 90s, and there was even an international arbitration to settle the border conflict, but that has not been enforced and demarcated. And so the tension between these two has immediate impacts on what happens in Somalia. Both of them are suspicious that the other one tries to interfere, and it affects also the conflicts in Sudan and South Sudan. So in line with what I said before about territorial conflicts, it tells me one needs to settle that conflict first, and then we can perhaps relax some of the tension between Ethiopia and Eritrea, and that would improve the chances of moving towards peace in the other parts of the region. Again, in many other situations, easy to say when you sit at a desk far away from the scene, but it seems to me to be the thing that the international community should engage itself in.
Well, that's sort of my last question, I think, would be about the role of the international community, the role of mediators. How important is it to have committed third parties in trying to negotiate a peace agreement?
I think it is very important and often underestimated that you can say that many of the peace agreements that we have seen have actually been mediated through such third parties, and the UN has done it sometimes, but it can be others. It can be the African Union, as we talk about Africa. Clearly, the Pope had a role in getting the relationships reestablished between Cuba and the United States. So there are all kinds of third parties here that can play an important role. I think we need to learn from what has been achieved by such parties before and draw lessons from that. Only recently, in the past 4 or 5 years, has the UN created a special unit for the support of mediation. I think that it is important for countries to put more emphasis on mediation, developing mediation skills, because that is a way in which you can actually get the parties in a conflict to talk to each other, to get new ideas how to move forward and find a way in which they can relax their relationships. They can see new ways out. It strikes me often that when you meet people who are involved in particular vicious conflicts, how their minds is constantly on their side of the conflict and how difficult it is to see the conflict from the other side. And that is exactly what the third party or mediator can do. And it is my firm conclusion from other work that they actually do contribute quite a lot. And interestingly enough, small countries can play a particularly important role because they are not threats to any and they don't have vast international imperial ambitions. And we can also see that small countries do contribute a lot to mediation around the world.
Well, Peter Wallenstein, what a pleasure it has been to host you and to discuss your book, Quality Peace, Peacebuilding Victory and World Order. Thank you so much for being with us on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed our discussion.
When we come back, the birth of what we know as big science, the big money supported cross-institution collaborations that have supported both medicine and weaponry. Stay tuned.
Heal the broken hearted, wipe away the tears, heal the soldiers' wounds and the children's fear, heal the shattered lives and tattered family ties. Oh, let the war be done, let the peace be won. Right now, let the war be done. Let the peace be won. Right now.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How did science and government get so entrenched with industry and one another? And what have been the results? Our next guest has traced the history. Michael Hiltzig is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. His latest book is Big Science, Ernest Lawrence and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Michael Hiltzik. It is great to have you back with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm curious first why you decided to do this particular book. It seems like a departure from your past books and subjects. Why big science?
Well, it's a departure from some of my recent books, but not necessarily from my trend line. You know, a number of things came together at just the right moment. First, of course, I was looking for a new subject. I had just finished and published a book on the New Deal. I've always been interested in technology and science, and I've always had sort of a hobbyist interest in things like physics and quantum mechanics and things like that. And when you read enough in that field, it isn't long before you encounter the name of Ernest Lawrence. And that's also true when, as I was doing, you cover higher education in the U.S., because higher education means a lot of money being spent on big scientific projects, and he was the father of that trend. So he's often mentioned both as the father of, as I said, big science, but also as the father of modern physics because of his invention of the cyclotron. So this was going to enable me to write about the politics of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and the war, and physics, and technology, and to revive interest and knowledge about this very important scientific figure in the U.S. that most people had really forgotten about.
One of the things that was really remarkable was essentially Lawrence's role in transforming science from what you call small science to what we now call big science. Can you talk about the difference in what it was before Lawrence and then what we are talking about when we say big science?
Sure. Well, there was a continuum of how scientific research, particularly in chemistry and physics, was being done, and especially in physics at the time. We're talking about the very late 20s and the beginning of the 30s. And the older generation of physicists, these are people like Sir Ernest Rutherford and Marie Curie, had accomplished incredible things with the tools that nature gave them. They were using alpha ray emissions from thimblefuls of radium and other radioactive materials, and using those tools, they had discovered radioactivity and X-rays, and they had discovered the neutron, and they had figured out the internal structure of the atom itself. But they also understood that they had basically come to the end of that process, that to delve further into the atomic nucleus, they were going to need projectiles and tools of much greater energies, and that those were not going to be available from natural minerals, that it was going to require using man's ingenuity to build up those energies. And it was Rutherford himself who said, I would like to see an apparatus that can give me 10 electron volts and yet fit in a comfortably sized room. So he sort of set out that challenge to the younger generation, and Lawrence was there at the right moment. He had the right intuitions and the right instinct, and he discovered the way to do that, and that was the cyclotron. It was a way of placing energies on the projectile, in his case, initially protons, and driving them to higher energies without trying to put the energy onto the apparatus itself. And this was a really radical new concept, and he was able to put it into action.
The original cyclotron was really small compared to what it developed into. Tell us a little about what the cyclotron did, the size of it, and then its future, like the Hadron Collider, for example. So walk us through what it did and its size, and then its progeny.
Sure. The cyclotron concept was based on the fact that if you send a charged particle through a magnetic field, its path will curve. So Lawrence understood that if you send a proton, which has a positive charge of 1, through a magnetic field, you can twist it into a spiral, and that allows you to jolt it with new energies every time it crosses the same electrode gap. Now, that was the concept. It took a couple of years for him to actually get it to work, and his first cyclotron fit in the palm of his hand. It looked like a flask, a glass or metal flask that had been run over by a truck. It was slathered with red sealing wax to keep a vacuum inside it, and it cost less than $100 in material. Once he got that or its next generations working, every time he got new energies, he raised new questions about what these could do. So every generation of the cyclotron had to be bigger, it had to be more powerful. Inevitably, it was more expensive, and over a period of really less than a decade, he had gone from that little palm-sized unit to a cyclotron that needed a building to be built for it in a ravine above the Berkeley campus, and that was going to cost more than $1 million. This, of course, was a process that soon outstripped the ability of a university to pay for even a consortium of universities, and that's why Lawrence began to turn to research foundations and the government and eventually industry as well. And that's how big science came about. Forward to the present day, the Large Hadron Collider is the largest atom smasher in the world. It occupies a tunnel that's 17 miles in circumference. It's buried under the border between France and Switzerland, and it cost $9 billion to build. And what it's got in it is several cyclotrons and synchrocyclotrons and other offspring of Lawrence's original concept. So you can see sort of the evolution of these machines over time.
The Large Hadron Collider is really the essence of big, which you noted in your book titled Big Science, of course, that took, what, 25 years, I think you said, $10 billion. How can we understand just how big this really is?
Well, I think we can understand it by there's actually a photograph in my book of a man standing inside the tunnel of the Large Hadron Collider. And, of course, he's dwarfed by the machinery around him, and you compare that to a unit that fit in the palm of somebody's hand. And, of course, the energies that these devices can produce today are unimaginable. They were even unimaginable to somebody with the imagination of an Ernest Lawrence, who himself was thinking way ahead of his own contemporaries. But you now need those energies to essentially create or to see at least the signs of new particles that are themselves the building block of subatomic particles and the atom and the world we live in.
I think one of the most important results that we saw from Lawrence was, as you mentioned, the military-industrial complex, the bombs, the World War II, but also the academy. He was the first to really go after all this money and convince the government to put its resources into science, and then the development of big science as an institution in of itself. So I wonder if we could walk through each of these. Perhaps we should start with, you mentioned the first time a scientist had started going to foundations, going to the government. Tell us a little bit about how he did this and how it developed into today.
Yeah, I think that scientific research was sort of lucky in having a person like Lawrence in that place at that time. His personality really lent itself to this sort of, to being an impresario, to being a ringleader and a manager. He was a prototypical CEO of a research center. He was amiable. He was smart. He knew how to talk to university presidents and foundation chairmen and industrial CEOs very easily. It may have had a lot to do with his upbringing as a small-town boy in rural South Dakota. He was very American. He had an air about him that was very different from the stern European mien of physicists of the past. So his personality really lent itself to his ability to do that. And, of course, he had this other quality, which is that when he promised that he would achieve something, he almost always delivered on that promise. So if he was going to the Rockefeller Foundation or the Macy Foundation, which was doing a lot of funding of medical research, and he could say, look, you know, this is my goal, this is what I'm going to do, they could look at his record and they could see that he actually had achieved what he had promised the last time around. And, you know, he was somebody who always had the next machine on the drawing board when the last one was still being built. So he brought these people along with him. His enthusiasm was really infectious. And, of course, the fact that he actually could deliver was very, very important at this stage when he's out there on the very leading edge of physics. Now, the point came when the needs for his technology really went beyond even what foundations could do, what corporations could do. And at that moment, we were about to enter the war, and the government was in the mode of becoming the most important patron of basic scientific research. And there was Lawrence. He was very friendly with the scientific leadership of the government at the time, and he moved very smoothly into the patronage of the government from industry and foundations and universities.
I got the sense from reading your book that this kind of raised eyebrows at the time, that a lot of scientists weren't really comfortable with this cozy kind of relationship and their concerns about strings attached. What are the ethical concerns that were raised at the time, and integrate them into what you see today?
There was sort of a series of phases. You have to remember that when this process really began, first of all, when he was dealing with universities and foundations, there weren't a lot of ethical concerns raised by other scientists. They understood that these were entities devoted to basic science. They were willing to allow the scientists that they were funding to follow their own noses. At the point that he began to get involved with the military, we were entering the war, and most of the scientific community, particularly the physics community, was very interested in doing this sort of work because a lot of them had come from Germany and Austria. They were very, very panicky about the thought that Hitler would get his hands on the secrets of nuclear fission and create a bomb that they knew was at least plausible and feasible. So at the point that Lawrence began to develop his relationship with the government and the military, the rest of the scientific community was okay with that. They had a job to do. It was an urgent job, and Lawrence helped organize the Manhattan Project. He played a key role in the scientific management of that project. And I think most of his colleagues had faith that he knew what he was doing and that he would protect them from political interference, and he did. Now, that became harder to do in the post-war period when many of the scientists who had worked on the Manhattan Project began to have second thoughts about the work they had done, no matter how urgent and important they thought it was at the time, and especially once the U.S. government began to get very interested in the hydrogen bomb. This is a new technology. Many of the physicists who had worked on the atomic bomb were very uncomfortable with it. They viewed it as a weapon that would be good only for genocide or as a psychological menace. Many of them did not want to work on it, but it was Lawrence who kept pushing it ahead. And that, I think, led to a lot of doubts about the propriety of working with Lawrence and with the government at that time. The government in the post-war years was much more interested in attaching strings to its patronage. A lot of physicists who wanted to move back into civilian life were very uncomfortable with that. So you began to see this real split within the scientific community about these relationships, really starting after 1945.
There were some problems, of course, too, in his science. He got sort of busted at one of the conferences that dealt with the deuteron and having contaminated the results. What did that mean in this big picture?
We're going back to the 1930s now, and this was a period in which Lawrence himself was sort of learning how to be a scientist. I think it's something that many scientists have to go through. They have to learn how to divorce their thrill with the technology that they have on hand from the need to actually come up with results. Lawrence and his team at Berkeley in the early days, they were really focused on building up the technology, on building bigger cyclotrons that were more and more capable. And in that era, actual scientific research often took a back seat to this desire to build the machine. As I said, in the radiation lab, which was Lawrence's lab at Berkeley, you could be forgiven for not bringing a scientific project to fruition, but you could not be forgiven for missing your shift tending the cyclotron. A lot of scientists just, could not deal with that. He lost a few very talented men, but many saw that once the cyclotron was perfected, the ability to do research would be great. But in the process, Lawrence got a lot of things wrong. his team missed a couple of very important developments. They missed the discovery of artificial radiation, which was discovered by Marie Curie, even though they had the best equipment to make this discovery. And the Deuteron affair, which you just mentioned, involved what Lawrence thought was his discovery of what was going on when a deuteron, that's the nucleus of a helium atom, strikes a target within the cyclotron. He used his findings to develop a theory about the weight of the neutron, which other scientists, much more experienced scientists, especially at Cambridge University in England, thought was wrong. And then he presented his results at a very important scientific conference in Brussels, and he was shown to be wrong. He had to climb down. His reputation was really at risk because experienced researchers thought that he had been incompetent in doing this. He had tried to claim results that were not supported by the data. And I think he learned a lot from that. He learned humility, certainly, and he learned really the need to do the actual research much more rigorously. And that, I think, was a turning point for his lab. And after that, they didn't make that mistake again.
So let's bring in Oppenheimer now. He was, as you described, the great theorist, whereas Lawrence was a great experimentalist. So we're fast forwarding now. You said their relationship was quite enigmatic, but also probably the most responsible for developing big science. How would you describe that relationship before Oppenheimer got into some trouble?
Robert Oppenheimer got to Berkeley a year or so after Ernest did, and as you said, Oppenheimer was probably the most talented physics theorist in the United States at the time. Lawrence's grasp of theory was not always very strong, but he was a great experimentalist, and of course Oppenheimer was useless around a machine. So they had a symbiotic relationship. They had a great relationship. And at the beginning of this time, they were very, very close friends. Lawrence's first son, Robert, was named after Oppenheimer. The family socialized together. They were very, very close. But they were very different. And in fact, a lot of their colleagues spent half their lives trying to figure out what drew Ernest Lawrence and Robert Oppenheimer together, and then spent half their lives trying to figure out what led to their very, very bitter breakup later in their lives. As you said, it was an odd relationship. Started out very warm. It ended very bitter. But at the key moments from the 1930s and into the 1940s, it was very, very close. In fact, it was Lawrence who nominated Oppenheimer to run the lab that would become Los Alamos under the Manhattan Project. And he even had to vouch for Oppenheimer when the U.S. Army said, you know, Oppenheimer's a leftist. We're not sure he's not a communist. It was Lawrence who stepped forward and said, I will keep him under control. If he runs off the rails, I will be there to fix it. And that was enough for General Leslie Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, to basically sign off on Oppenheimer's appointment.
But then he was eventually, his security clearance was revoked, Oppenheimer's. So what happened for the revocation to occur?
Well, that's the tragedy of Robert Oppenheimer. After the war, he not only opposed the development of the hydrogen bomb, but he spoke out against it. He became a great campaigner against nuclear proliferation and the development of thermonuclear weapons, and of course a very respected one because of his role in the war. He had become, you know, he had been sort of a shy, mumbling figure at the beginning of the 30s when he and Lawrence first began their friendship, and he had developed into essentially a world figure, world-famous physicist, scientist, and statesman. Now, in opposing the hydrogen bomb, Oppenheimer ran afoul of a man named Louis Strauss, who was the head of the Atomic Energy Commission under Truman and Eisenhower, and was a fanatic fan of developing the hydrogen bomb. Strauss was the type of person who, if you disagreed with him, he at first thought you were an idiot and then concluded you were a traitor, and that's the way he viewed Oppenheimer. So it was Strauss who really started this campaign to revoke Robert Oppenheimer's security clearance and staged essentially a trial of Oppenheimer to revoke that clearance, in which physicists of great renown from all over the country essentially had to take sides, either for Oppenheimer or against him. the real tragedy in this relationship, I think, is that almost every physicist in the U.S., certainly every physicist who had worked in the Manhattan Project, was on Oppenheimer's side and defended him at this trial. The only people who were against him were Ernest Lawrence and his team at Berkeley. And they came very close to testifying at this procedure against Oppenheimer and then decided that it was better for them if they just stood down and they didn't testify at all.
So do you think ultimately it was politics that divided Lawrence and Oppenheimer?
It was chiefly politics, but I think their personalities and their different lifestyles really played into this and played an important role. I think if they had political disagreements, but they were two different people than they were, I don't think it would have been as bitter a breakup as it became. You have to really think about how fundamentally different in personality these two people were. Lawrence, as I said, was a small-town boy. He was married to the same woman all his life. Robert Oppenheimer was a New Yorker, a New York City born and bred. He had been trained in Europe. He had gotten an education of a sophistication that Lawrence didn't have. He was sort of a boulevardier. He was a womanizer. He was married twice. He had a lot of affairs, including one with the wife of a very close friend of Lawrence that Lawrence thought very bitterly about. So you had all these elements. Oppenheimer was into politics. Lawrence tried to stay away from politics as much as he could, especially the sort of leftist socialist politics that Oppenheimer espoused. So you had all these elements, and when you add onto it this fundamental disagreement about a project that Lawrence was committed to and that Oppenheimer was publicly speaking out against, it was an explosive formula, and it really did end in serious breach.
Let's talk also about Lawrence's influence on medicine. With his brother and with Harvey Williams Cushing, they really contributed a lot to this field of nuclear medicine. Tell us about that.
Well, a couple of things came together. First of all, Ernest was very sensitive to waves of funding in the scientific community. There was a period early in the development of the cyclotron when funding for hard physics was drying up. This is foundation funding. But funding for medical research was surging. Now, Ernest Lawrence was always on the lookout for patronage. He needed a lot of money to build his machine. So he began to think harder about what the cyclotron could do, what the technology could do for medical science. Now, his younger brother, John, was a medical doctor who was also interested in this field. So they came together and they worked together to develop what became the field of nuclear medicine. John Lawrence was one of the first professors of nuclear medicine. He got the appointment at the University of California at what was then Berkeley's Medical School, which was in San Francisco, which is now UC San Francisco. And they worked together to develop the capabilities of using radiation to diagnose and cure disease in ways that are still being used today. A lot of the machines, diagnostic equipment that's used today was pioneered by Ernest and John Lawrence at this very, very early stage. At the same time, Ernest was beginning to use the cyclotron to develop new isotopes that were not seen in the natural world, that he could create by bombarding existing elements. Some of these became very important diagnostic and curative tools in medicine as well.
You opened your book talking about the Higgs boson and how it has come out of big science. If you are going to say the other really big contributions that have come from this, essentially from this guy who transformed science and wedded it with government and big foundations, what would you say the other big contributions have been?
Well, I'd say if you look around, big science is all around us. It was critical in developing not only nuclear science, but also advances in biology. The Human Genome Project, that's a big science project. Addressing climate change, that's going to require big science. If we define big science as capital-intensive, interdisciplinary research at a very basic level, then you can see that there's so much around us that depends on this paradigm. But at the same time, of course, it unleashed the destructive force of the nucleus as well. So I quoted in my book Raymond Fosdick, who was the chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation, who funded Ernest's largest cyclotron. This was in the late 1930s and early 1940s, who said, "We can't say science itself is good or evil. We can only talk about what humankind makes of this knowledge and these achievements." And I think that's the way we have to look at big science. It really, as I also quoted James Franck, who was a German emigre physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project and who knew Lawrence and who knew all this technology, he said, look, what we have done with big science is we have brought science past the point in which scientists can any longer disavow responsibility for their discoveries. There's just too much at stake. The destructive power of what we have discovered is greater than all the discoveries of mankind put together in the past. So I think big science has brought science to that point where scientists have to think about what the implications are of what they do. And this is very difficult both for science and for society at large, and I'm not sure we have solved that problem yet. But all we can say is that it's big science that still fulfills man's undying quest for knowledge in ever more important ways.
And it's also transformed the academy itself.
Well, it definitely has. The need to raise money, to marshal resources, and to manage these huge teams and huge funds really has turned university professors and university presidents into impresarios and promoters and CEOs. It's taken them away from the work of actually doing science in a way that I think has made many people uncomfortable, and rightly so. But I think that trend is only going to continue because big science itself drives its leaders to raise more money and build more to make science ever bigger, to answer ever bigger questions.
Michael Hiltzik, thank you for joining us again here on the Scholar Circle.
I'm happy to be here.
Michael Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's the author of 6 books, including the one we've been talking about, Big Science, Ernest Lawrence, and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
Let the war be done. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won. Let the wars be done. Live in peace as one.